reality. And the individual, for an instant, seemed to tune in on that reality and become with it. This, with Plotinus, lasted only a few seconds. But once having been experienced, the whole life was changed, not only for this embodiment, but for future embodiments. The tremendous experience of universality indicates the final means of communication. God or deity communicates through a series of inward experiences. These experiences can be crystallized into codes. They can become the basis of religions or creeds or doctrines. They can result in improvements of society and the evolution of human culture. But the experience itself, like the experience of Moses on the height of Sinai, is something that cannot be actually communicated. And in the silence of his contemplation, the Zen monk, the Christian monk, the Buddhist monk, all have moments in which they feel very near to the realities which they seek. And they have also learned something else, that you must finally decide in your own consciousness where you want communication to come from. Do you wish to have the world move in on you with all of its attitudes and ideals and ideas, all of its forms of knowledge and skills? Do you want to have life a communication from the outside, from the material world about us, a communication which may lead to material success or create more problems that it can ever solve? But in any event, that the building up of knowledge is an experience from environment, from the institutional, traditional forms of learning which have come down to us from the past. The other type of learning is not this at all. It is a learning for which you must prepare by quieting the mind and the emotions and allowing them to become recipient of a power greater than that from external pressures. Now, the great problem in meditation, of course, is the danger of negation. The individual, in some religious groups, tries to make the mind a blank, tries to take the attitude that if he doesn't think at all, the divine mind will think in him or through him. This, however, is a dangerous approach to the subject. It is not good for the individual to simply wait passively for some type of communication from a superior source. This passivity is not necessary if the proper background has been built. In other words, if the individual has prepared themselves quite correctly for the acceptance of a meditational life, then it is not negation, but quietude, a calmness which is strong and not weak, but which is not associated to the forms of expression which are detrimental to inner revelation. By self-discipline, by gradually freeing oneself from the involvements of an illusional existence, the inner life is cleansed and purified, and a certain quiet ardor is added. It is a quiet expectancy, a quiet hope, but it is strong. It is built upon self-discipline, the rejection of illusions, decisions of dedication, which gradually produce in the individual the capacity to receive intuitional information from within. So that this type of meditational acceptance is very, very important in development, but it is not something in which you simply make yourself a blank. Rather, it is something in which you clean the surface of the paper, but it is still there, and it is something in which you will gradually be able to experience an inner strength rather than an inner weakness or insecurity. Actually, the experiences of meditation are very dramatic and dynamic, but they are very quiet. They are a great peace with an indestructible strength associated with it, so strong that no error or illusion, no attachment that is unreasonable can possibly take it over and misuse the growth that you have accomplished. Now also we have a series of intimate problems working with people. The physician is perhaps an ideal example of the problem of communication. Recently, there has been a rise in the importance of so-called general medicine, the family physician. For a long time, we had a highly intellectualized medical situation in which the family physician was little better than an intern working for specialists. In this particular situation, we had something against which human nature has gradually revolted, and that is the professional person who has no time, no energy, and no interest in the actual life of his patient. He is there to have his nurse give a shot or prescribe a pill or write a prescription. He is not interested, he is not a physician in the essential meaning of the word. He is a human computer, merely preparing and disseminating certain information which he has learned and which perhaps privately he hopes is correct. This situation has resulted in a great decline in the value of medicine to the human being. And the next step has been the gradual restoring of the family physician. The individual who takes the time to be a friend of his patient, who takes the necessary means to win the confidence and understanding of the sick, a person who is a gentle, kindly, understanding human being. In other words, that the physician must first be a human being. Otherwise, most of his services are less successful than they should be. Many patients really do not need elaborate medications. What they really need is a little sympathy, a little ability to share their problems or to unload a burden of psychic stress within themselves. They are looking for a counselor, and in one way or another, they are looking for a priest. In the ancient Greek medical religion, the shrines of Asclepius, the god of healing, were for centuries in the hands of the family and descendants of one medically integrated group. They were all priests. They were all dedicated to the temple. They were all initiated into the religious mysteries of their time. They compared their values not only scientifically, but with the great spiritual revelations of mankind. The patient came as to a spiritual father. He came to be helped, to be instructed, to be inspired, and if necessary, to have his character somewhat altered or modified in order to bring peace and health to his life. Now, these priest physicians had tremendous influence because they were priests. The individual who disregarded their ministry was therefore violating his religious obligations. He must listen to the voice of the priest physician as he might listen to the voice of the gods. He was in the presence of the initiated, illuminated teacher, not merely a practitioner in medicine. Now again, the diagnosis under those conditions was quite different from what we know today. For the most part, the diagnosis was non-vocal, or was not given in words, or by means of tests, such as we would use today. There were no laboratories, as we would call them, no blood tests, no elaborate equipment. And the individual, therefore, was diagnosed very largely by the gods. At the great temple of Asclepius, the sick were brought in at night on couches and were placed in a circle around the statue of the deity. Then the priest gave each of them a soothing, probably sedational drink that quieted the nerves and eased pain where it was present. The individuals, the patients, then slept in the temple, in the circle around the deity. In the morning, they reported their dreams to the priest physicians. And in nearly every instance, the dream was the diagnosis. Nothing was spoken. It was a non-vocal diagnosis. The individual could repeat it afterwards to the priest, but he was actually diagnosed by some power deeper than his conscious mind. Perhaps, as some psychologists might say, he was diagnosed by his own subconscious, or he was diagnosed by his own internal faculties. But the consequence of it was that in most cases, the patient told the priests the correct diagnosis of his ailment. The priest then administered the material as recommended in the dream, because they felt something that we have again forgotten, that each sickness, each person who is sick, is suffering from a problem which only his own consciousness can finally solve, and all other efforts are to a degree ineffective. They may help, but the final diagnosis of what is wrong with us usually has to come from ourselves. Not verbal, but from experiences, dreams, archetypal visions, and things of this nature. Because actually, we are the only one in the world who knows just exactly what is wrong with ourselves. Others guess at it, and sometimes the guessing is very irritating to the sufferer. But the final answer lies in the person's quiet contemplation of his own situation. Therefore, in a sense, symptoms are a nonverbal form of communication. Symptoms arise in the person, and for the most part, he takes them immediately to some physician or nutritionist or something of this nature. Actually, however, all these symptoms that arise in himself should be studied deeply by the person himself. If he is not in a position to study, if he doesn't know what it's all about, then he is in a very bad shape, because he is living in a house, but he does not know how to take care of it. He does not know when it needs repairs. He does not know when its roof leaks. He does not know how to keep it properly in order. And for the most part, he pays no attention to it. And when things get very bad, he moves out. Now, in this case, when he moves out, he has to wait for a new body. But a great many people will move out of an apartment when they can no longer clean it up. It becomes too odious a job to put things back in order. So with the person, health problems nearly always require or invite very serious consideration. We are the only ones who know the whole story of ourselves. Psychoanalysis tries to help with it. But by the time the whole story is told to another person, presuming that we have told it correctly, which is not always the case, we have not only spent a great deal of time, but a very large sum of money, while somebody is listening to our troubles. Actually, no one, even though they listen attentively, can be all-knowing or guarantee the improvement that we seek. In fact, no one but ourselves can guarantee that we'll even follow the advice that is given to us. Usually, if it is something we do not like, we will not even bother to follow it, or we'll start out half-heartedly and forget it in a short time. So each person, in the presence of changes in life, is in the presence of a great system of instruction. by means of which he can improve or maintain health, extend his reasonable expectancies, and cope correctly with the deficiencies which time and wear and tear bring into his physical economy. All these things are part of a great instruction, and the body is patiently telling us every day how to take care of it and what is best for it. In some cases, we are not able to meet the requirement of the body, but in many instances, we can do something toward that to improve the general condition in which we live. Now, art is something I think we should mention in passing. Art is in a rather poor shape at the present time. I think we will all admit that the art archetype has revealed a great deal of the infirmity of human nature. Good art is never dated. A great artistry belongs to eternity. The great principles of beauty are unchanging. Beauty does not talk, but beauty comforts us if we are able to experience its influence. So that in this, the study of art, we have to analyze the lives of the artists to discover the degree to which they are sincere. A sincere artist will produce a sincere picture. A commercialist who is only interested in trying to sell his art does not have the same vibratory communication for us. And art which is shoddy is of no value either to the artist or the person who purchases it, because it carries no validity, no integrity, no proper development. Some of the great artists of the world, I imagine, are in the Oriental system. The reason why this is true is because essentially, up to within the last century, the great artistic canons of the East were never qualified or abused. Even now, there are many artists in Asia who are sincerely attempting to restore the integrities of the great art of the past. There are a few modernists who, under one influence or another, sometimes a bit of heroin helps, are producing mysterious terrors, passing them off as art. But to a large degree, the art of the East is a nonverbal transmission of an inward experience. The Eastern artist tries to live the art which he practices. If he is deciding to paint a beautiful picture of a mountain with forests and clouds, he will go out and he will sit on the side of the hill and look at that mountain. He will look at it for hours, perhaps for days. In fact, he might even build a little retreat there and look at it for years, trying to experience within himself the message that that mountain has for him. His technique is very simple. All Oriental techniques are so simple that they never interfere with the representation of the value intended. It is no longer a case of a very elaborate palette, no problem of tremendous mixing of colors and a long study of conventional methods. The simple line, the simple design, is taught for one purpose only. Not that the artist shall have a fine technique, but that the artist shall be capable of losing himself in the subject he is depicting. After maybe months of meditation in front of a blank sheet of silk, with a few strokes, the artist will complete the picture. He has digested it. He has assimilated it. He has taken from it every bit of meaning he can comprehend. He has made it an experience of consciousness. And having finally put the whole subject in order, with a few moments, he makes the physical representation of it. Now, as it was pointed out in connection with Sesshu, one of the great artists of Japan, Artists themselves are classified according to the degree of internal consciousness they have attained. A great connoisseur in Japan, a great art collector in China, is not a person who buys expensive pictures by name artists. He isn't buying a picture. He is not buying a label. He is not buying fame or notoriety. He is looking for integrity. And looking at the picture that has been produced by a truly inspired artist, he says to himself, the connoisseur says to himself, this artist has attained the fifth stage of internal meditation. He has reached a certain point, and he has put down on this silk, actually, a statement of himself, of what he knows, what he believes, what he has experienced, and how he has been able to interpret the symbolism of this mountain. He goes along a little further, and he sees another picture. And he says, this artist has achieved the seventh degree of consciousness. He has seen more deeply than the other one. He has experienced more wealth of inner insight. He has released more soul power because he has the inner meditational quality that has made him a greater artist than the other, although the other artist is also very fine. So the connoisseur will go through the gallery measuring the pictures by consciousness, not by appearance or name. Now, it is obvious that under such situation or condition, the purchaser must have the degree of insight that he is able to recognize in the artist's work. Unless the purchaser has attained the seventh degree of insight, he cannot know that the artist has. The connoisseur, therefore, is not a person who simply buys and puts away or builds a gallery to store something. He must have the experience also, for it is only what we have experienced in ourselves that we can recognize in others. If we have not achieved it in ourselves, we cannot know that another person has achieved it. This then goes not only into the world of art and sumi paintings and beautiful screens. It also goes into the religious art of these people. For the Asiatic has come nearer to being able to make a pictorial representation of invisibles than probably any other school in the world. He has been able to transcend the forms of things without distortion and has bound it all together by a tremendous language of symbolism. Every part of these designs is a symbol which draws the attention of the person who understands. If you do not know the meaning of the symbol, you will not buy the picture. If you know the meaning, and that meaning is nourishing to your consciousness, you will make a great sacrifice to have that painting or to experience the work of a beautiful bit of pottery. For the potter, just as much as the painter, is telling the story of soul power. And a great potter reveals through his work the victory of soul power over physical materials. For he has made these materials become symbols of things unseen. So with the same with life as we go out in the experiences of living, we recognize in others that which we have attained in ourselves. We may have respect and veneration for that which we have not yet attained, but we can only understand and build into consciousness that which is within the range of our available reflective powers and faculties. Thus, the only way in which we can finally experience truth is to have attained it in ourselves, therefore become capable of experiencing it in other things. Whatever deficiency there is in our own natures, there will be a corresponding deficiency in our philosophy, in our religion, and for that matter, in our science. A world that has not yet attained to the mystical levels of things will continue to be plagued by the problems of material existence. We are now in the midst of a very sad situation, but one in which nonverbal communication is probably more important than ever before. For it is only by the thoughtful contemplation of things as they are that we can gradually restore our own integrities. We have to learn the lesson in order to escape the consequences of former mistakes. It is not possible for us to listen to people promising this, guaranteeing that, and demanding something else. The only thing that will solve our problem is the victory of soul power over brute force, and until that comes, there is no solution. But if this solution is first to be attained in ourselves, and we can see in many ways how this attainment is available in comparatively simple people. We find in many cases that those less sophisticated have greater integrities, that in very simple solutions, the individual living close to experiences has been able to grow by actually feeling the way life is, rather than listening to experts talking about it. So all the way through the problem of healing and through the problems of sickness, we have this line cutting, a line which tells us that a great deal of health will come from integrities that can restore the imbalances that we have permitted to arise within ourselves. Religious institutions in all parts of the world are restoring religious healing and pointing out the advantages of more internalization of the search for health. There seems to be no reasonable doubt, and it is demonstrated from the beginning of time, that where a group of sincere persons unites its efforts to be helpful, to help to restore the health of the sick, that they have a great effectiveness if the patient is willing to accept the values involved. Spiritual healing is perhaps best personified or exemplified in the story of the great shrine at Lourdes, where spiritual healing has been practiced for hundreds of years. Here, there is a great difference in the results obtained. Many who have gone to Lourdes very sincerely have not been helped. Some, however, have been miraculously aided. And the only difference that can be imagined is the internal quality of consciousness. The individual who had a certain type of consciousness got the results. Another who went even with a strong faith was not helped. It was more than faith that was necessary. There was something deeper than faith. It was the person becoming in rapport with the spiritual power of healing, the rapport of God as health, God as body harmony, God as spirit moving into flesh in the mystery of divine enlightenment. So that healing has become important now, partly because so much sickness is not due to lack of advantage. It is now due very largely to lack of self-discipline, lack of the power to have a constructive, creative, idealistic relationship with life. Much of our health problem today is being endured by people who have wealth, who have education, who are profitably employed, and who have more or less integrated families. It is not the fact that we cannot afford health that is responsible for sickness. It is that we cannot afford internal ignorance. We cannot afford to live below the level upon which health is possible. Health is only finally possible when the individual's internal nature is supporting his material structure. Only an idealist can be truly healthy. Others may be strong, may be vital, may win Olympic titles. But true strength arises from a wise administration of the body by the being within it. It is only when the soul leads and the body follows that you can have the best and most reasonable manifestation of health. It may be that evolution has not yet given us the full power to be all that we desire to be or to correct all of our faults. But one thing is certain, we are better off when our ideals lead the way. We are far better off when we keep faith with the inner life than when we try to live against it and depend upon the crutches and helps and implements of modern science. Actually, wisdom, love, health, all these virtues are the result of obedience to the divine plan. The better we obey, the better off we are. The more we understand, the better we can obey. Always there has to be a certain inner growth. This inner growth cannot be perhaps entirely nonverbal, but it is largely so, because there's no matter what we hear, what we read, what we see, the things in themselves are not solutional. It is what we internally do. When we transmute experience or tradition or history or philosophy or religion into soul power. And this soul power has to be an internal achievement, usually in the quiet of the night, usually alone in the wilderness, usually under some type of affliction, which finally brings us face to face with ourselves and the jobs that we have to do. So in all our problems and in all the things that we have to do to learn, we can read moderately, we can listen moderately, but it's not what we read or what we hear that does it. It is what we are able to do by means of instruction to release and transform our own inner lives. To memorize everything in the world will not solve our problems, unless the memory is supporting a major change within our own natures. If we can use instruction to change ourselves, to accomplish the gradual reformation of ourselves, then we are gaining on it. But within the body is this soul psychic factor, above the mind, above the emotions, and above the flesh. This is the natural leader. And when we obey its rules, we will succeed. It will gradually disseminate itself throughout all the parts of our structures, our nervous systems, our glandular systems, our arterial systems. All of these will be influenced by the psychic integrity at the source of ourselves. And it is when this integrity is finally brought into focus, and that which is the best of us becomes the ruler of the rest, then and then only do we achieve the health we desire. And in world affairs, when the highest type of our experience becomes the guide to our social relationships, and when the great teachers of the world are recognized as having established patterns which will work, but it is only when the individual outgrows his own selfishness that society can outgrow its troubles. There's no way of becoming good and remaining weak. There has to be strength. There has to be the gradual integration of our total personalities. We may not feel that it's profitable, but it is profitable because in due time, the integrity inside of ourselves will neutralize the pain of sickness, the suffering of ignorance, and the tragedies of misapplied energy. It's only in this way that we can accomplish. And it is the divine plan that this achievement is possible to each individual. It is not something in which we have to wait for the reformation of society. In fact, the reformation of society waits upon the integrity of the individual. Realizing this, we are on the way to getting things worked out in a better way. Well, folks, I guess that's all for this morning.